Hi, it's John Hamel, editor in chief of the peer reviewed journal Partner Abuse, and a member of the Association of Domestic Violence Intervention Programs, or ADVIP for short. This is podcast number 2 of our podcast series. Today is July 5th, 2018, and I'm going to be talking with Daniel Sonkin, a licensed marriage and family therapist and PhD in private practice in Sausalito, California. And he's one of the pioneers in developing evidence-based programs for domestic violence perpetrators. Welcome to the podcast, Daniel.
Thank you, John. Good morning.
I'm really glad to have you. You're a good friend and one of the real pioneers in the field. I think our listeners are going to be really happy to hear you. Let's start off with a question that kind of gets us started on the topic of this podcast today, which is attachment theory. So can you explain just for our listeners who may not be completely familiar with attachment theory, what is attachment theory from your point of view?
Well, attachment theory was a concept or a theory developed by a British psychiatrist, John Bowlby, and it was further elaborated by American psychologist Mary Ainsworth. And it's essentially a theory of child social emotional development. Emotional regulation is a very important task in childhood and also a central aspect of all interpersonal relationships. And because emotional distress is inevitable in life, it's really about a theory that talks about how children develop emotion regulation capacities, and that it you know, with the assumption, the idea that some coping skills are better than others. And so you have what's called secure attachment, which is what would be considered an adaptive form of emotional regulation. And you have insecure attachment, which would be a maladaptive form of emotional relationship. And this field has been growing in the past 50 years. And has really gone from a child development theory to really talking about adults as well, and how attachment patterns persist from the very early age of months and years old to people well into adulthood. And again, it gives us an understanding of how they deal with emotions in the context of close relationships.
Okay. So are you saying, Daniel, then somebody, let's say, who grew up as a child insecurely, that they're likely as adults to also have insecure attachments with their family members, intimate partners, and so forth?
Yes. And in fact, there's about an 80% continuity pattern. So about 80% of people who have secure attachment in childhood are likely to have secure attachment in adulthood, and vice versa. Those who have insecure attachment, about 80% of them are likely to have insecure patterns in their adult relationships. And again, it's because emotion regulation is such an important part of human functioning, and particularly interpersonal relationships. You want to have the most adaptive forms of emotion regulation in your close relationships, because you want those relationships to function in a positive, growthful, and mutually satisfying way.
So let me ask you then, I guess this naturally leads to our the second question I wanted to pose to you. So how is all this information applicable to intimate partner violence?
Well, you know, like I said, attachment theory in essence was a theory of affect regulation. And domestic violence for the past 30 or 40 years has been viewed as a problem of regulation of affect, anger and fear in particular. Obviously, attachment theory was all about interpersonal relationships. And of course, domestic violence is about close interpersonal relationships. And what was most got domestic violence researchers most interested in attachment is how consistent the data on insecure attachment in adult relationships really paralleled domestic violence relationships. Insecure attachment has been described with behaviors of uncontrolled anger, jealousy, control, and those are all similar patterns that we see in domestic violence relationships.
Yeah, can you elaborate on that? I found this in my own work with domestic violence offenders. That with everything that you're saying, I've seen that in my own clients. Could you elaborate on that? The whole idea about the relationship between feeling insecure, the anger that comes with it, the role of anger in people who are insecurely attached, along with jealousy, possessiveness. I see them as all being related.
Well, when you think about infants and the expression of their emotions, one of them is going to be anger. They're angry because they're tired and not able to rest. They're angry because they're hungry and they're not being fed. I mean, these basic emotions that all human beings experience are going to form and develop based on the kind of caretaking environment they're in. So, for example, if a parent ignores the emotional pleas or cues of the infant eventually learns to shut down and avoid expressing affect because they're not going to get their needs met. If a parent is only a sensitive part of the time, is inconsistent, then that seems to have just the opposite effect. The anger and the frustration gets higher and more intense with the infant, and as if, you know, increasing the volume is going to get the attachment figure to respond. And if the parent is sensitive to the cues of the infant, and this is really what, you know, attachment theory has really taught us about both infants but also about adult relationships, that emotional sensitivity is critical in close relationships, that we need to hear and understand and be empathic towards the emotional responses of the people that we love and care about. And when that happens, the infant is able to soothe and be soothed by the caregiver. And in domestic violence relationships, you have very similar relationships. You have individuals who shut down their emotions because they don't think they're going to get the kind of emotional soothing or caring that they hope for. And so there may be a long period of kind of, you know, I hate using the word repression because it drums up thoughts of psychoanalytic, which I'm not speaking to, but a holding back of emotion. And, you know, the more that we hold back, the more likely something is going to trigger an explosion. And the same thing with the other form of insecure attachment, which we call preoccupied, which would be an anxious attachment that is very clingy and demanding and so on. So you see these patterns in domestic violence relationships. So it just seemed to be kind of a natural fit to start thinking about domestic violence dynamics in terms of attachment theory. And of course, you know, like I said, that although violence is not the result of insecure attachment, insecure attachment can lead to violent behaviors, because there's lots of people who are insecurely attached in this world who aren't physically or psychologically violent in their relationships. But it can be a precursor. It could kind of set the path for someone becoming physically abusive, because we know there are other factors that contribute to domestic violence behaviors, not just insecure attachment.
Yeah, for example, like early experiences of shame, right?
Early experiences of shame, witnessing family violence as a child, alcohol and drugs, we know, play a big role. So you know, there has to be, more than just insecure attachment for someone to be at risk for domestic violence.
Okay, so let me ask you, would you just touch on a few of the studies that have been done, empirical studies that look at attachment theory and its relationship to domestic violence? What have they found?
Well, actually, the best place to find that would be in Mario Michelinzer and Phil Shaver's book, attachment in adulthood. In that book, they actually address, you know, in a very comprehensive way, many of the studies that have addressed issues around interpersonal violence and attachment theory. And there haven't been that many, but there's a growing number of studies that are looking at that. One of the first was Don Dutton's research in the late 80s on his typology research. He integrated attachment into that and found that all three forms of insecure attachment were found in populations of batterers. One way of, now there's another factor here, which is how do we even measure attachment? How do we even conceptualize a secure versus insecure attachment? And there's quite a number of ways of measuring it. One of the most popular ways these days is analysis of coherence of a interpersonal discourse, the adult attachment interview. It's an analysis of how people talk about their relationships. Pretty popular in the research literature is the use of self-report scales. And there's a number of scales that have been used. And one of the most popular ones is the Experiences in Close Relationship Scale, revised. And that was, again, developed by Phil Shaver in the attachment lab at University of California in Davis. And that scale conceptualized attachment on two continuums, and that is one measuring the degree of anxiety one feels in their close relationships and the degree of avoidance that they use in their close relationships. And if you have low avoidance and low anxiety, you're more likely to be securely attached. And if you have moderate or high anxiety or avoidance, you're likely to be insecure. And depending on how those all, whether it's high anxiety or high avoidance or both will depend on what attachment category that you have. But the three types of insecure attachment that we look at tend to be people who are avoidant or dismissing of attachment. And those are the people who kind of shut down their emotions and they don't turn towards attachment figures for care and comfort, which can be very difficult in relationships for partners, and also ultimately it's not good for the person who's doing that. And then you also have people who are highly anxious. These are people who are very clingy. They're very fearful of abandonment. They've used anger to get people's attention. And obviously that could be also problematic both for the partner as well as the person who's experiencing. And then you have people who have high anxiety and high avoidance, which is one of the more difficult forms of insecure attachment, which is referred to as either fearfully avoidant or disorganized. And these are people who seem to flip-flop between being highly clingy, demanding, and angry to being highly shut down. And so the studies that Shaver and Mikulenzer lay out in their book, Attachment in Adulthood, are really looking at, the results of many studies that have looked at how does anxiety play into domestic violence? How does avoidance play into domestic violence? And it turns out that both have a role, which I've already suggested. If you have high anxiety, you're worried about abandonment, you might be very clingy, you may be very demanding, you may be more likely to follow a person or restrict their activities because you're constantly hypervigilant about being rejected or being abandoned. And also, like I said earlier, that if there's high avoidance in an individual, that is also potentially a factor in violence. But what they found and what they decide in there, although both avoidance and anxiety could contribute to violent behavior, they really think the anxiety is a stronger contributor, that the studies show that anxiety is a more robust predictor of domestic violence than the avoidance. It doesn't mean that avoidance, people high in avoidance can't become violent too. It just means that based on their data, and it was reviewed in 2016, so we're only talking about data up until 2 years ago, that anxiety seemed to be, as they refer to, as the culprit in many domestic violence situations. So the question is then, you know, how do you interpret, you know, how do you integrate this into treatment? And again,
yeah, go before, ahead. Before you continue with that, Daniel, I was just going to say that, you know, the way that looks like in our clinical case, at least from my point of view, is the person that has, you know, this incredible anxiety. So they tend to be clingy, which pushes the other person away, which makes that clingy person even more feeling more abandoned. So they cling even more. Now, and if they're paired with, if somebody who's kind of clingy and has that anxious attachment, and they're paired with somebody that has a, you know, an avoidant type of attachment, talk about how that can really set up a really difficult dynamic.
Yeah. That is actually what's called the demand withdrawal dynamic, where one partner is demanding more from the other partner, and the other partner is overwhelmed. That it can go in both directions, John. So say the primary person with the violence problem is avoidant. What they, you know, intimacy is very, very difficult for them, and turning towards a partner for intimacy is not easy for them. But if they're paired with somebody who's extremely anxious and feels abandoned and is constantly demanding on them, that could lead to violence. And the same could also be true when the person who's at risk for violence is highly anxious and they're paired with a person who is dismissing, who is avoidant, who's shut down, and you're right, it just escalates that anxiety, and it could lead to violence. Now, you know, it doesn't. Although it seems like it would make sense that an anxious person might be more attracted to somebody who's more avoidant, or you know how opposites attract. That's true in many cases, but it's not always the case. Sometimes you have two anxious people in a relationship or two avoidant people in a relationship. And sometimes you have an anxious person with somebody who is secure in the relationship. So you know, there are no studies that I'm aware of that shows that if you're an anxious person, you're likely to be with somebody who's avoidant. I think there's a lot, again, like most things, there's a lot of factors that go into the partners that we choose. And attachment style might be one of those factors, but there are many other factors that contribute to a sort of mating dynamics.
Right. Yeah, I agree with everything you're saying. I've seen this in my own clinical practice, and in addition to, you know, all the research that's out there that I'm familiar with. Let's talk a little bit about how insecurely attached people also sometimes use psychological abuse, not just physical abuse, on their partners. One of the things that I've noticed over the years in my own clinical practice is that there seems to be a correlation between people who score high in attachment anxiety and the use of sort of controlling behaviors, in particular like jealous types of behaviors. So that yes. The experiences in the close relationships questionnaire, as you know, I've been using that in my clinical work. When I have someone refer to my program, court ordered to do a domestic violence perpetrator program, I administered that attachment questionnaire, and I also administer a questionnaire, the controlling and abusive tactics questionnaire, that measures emotional abuse. And I, over the years, I noticed that my clients who score high in attachment anxiety tend to score high in that section of the controlling and abusive tactics questionnaire that has to do with jealous, hypervigilant, jealous types of behaviors. So if you have a few minutes more, Daniel, I'd like to keep you on just to talk a little bit about a recent study that looked at the psychological abuse amongst people who are insecurely attached.
Right. In fact, we just put together conducted a really interesting study where we looked at 70 or 80 male perpetrators and about 20 female perpetrators, and looked at specifically that about the effects of attachment style, the relationship between attachment style and psychological abuse. You know, because first of all, you know, the reason why we should be interested in psychological abuse in general in the domestic violence field is because there's way more of that than there is physical and sexual abuse. And so it's far more common that there are unhappy relationships, not because there was physical abuse, but there was a lot of psychological abuse. And of course, jealousy is one of the most common forms that we see. And of course, that fits in with a person with anxious attachment, because this is their fear. Their fear is to be abandoned. Their fear is that they're not going to be loved enough. The fear is that the person's not going to be there when they need them. And so their solution to that is to be hyper vigilant and to stay in close proximity to their partner as much as possible. And when the partner does normal things like wants to go see a friend or visit family or whatever, you know, if they're going to be away, it triggers a lot of anxiety. And of course, the person with insecure attachment or the person with anxious attachment is going to cling on to them even more. And anyhow, so we did the study last year. And again, it showed a high correlation between insecure attachment and jealousy and controlling behavior. And that fit, you know, and the attachment field, what's been, you know, when people ask me, well, you know, why, you know, integrate attachment theory into domestic violence treatment, I just point to that. I just say, look, these are attachment studies that are not based on domestic violence cases, but the behaviors that you see are very, very similar to what we've been, you know, noting in our work for the past 40 years.
Right. And it I noticed, Daniel, that these findings on attachment seem to dovetail with previous studies. If you look back, for example, on the typology, you mentioned typologies proposed by Don Dutton. Also, Amy Holthrop Monroe
Yes.
probably has put forward the most popular one, which breaks down male perpetrators. It turns out that it same applies to females. But male perpetrators, she categorized them as either family only, dysphoric, borderline, or antisocial, generally violent. And the dysphoric, borderline type of men that she identified, research has found that these men, in fact, have a profile of that fearful attachment style, the disorganized attachment style that you mentioned. In other words, they're the ones who might be, in some ways, the most dangerous, or could be, at least in theory, in that the fearful attachment leads them to cling and to you know seek to get the comfort that they want. If they act out and they become violent, then afterwards they feel really bad and they want to get their partner back. So they also fit the profile of Lenore Walker's a classic three-phase cycle of abuse. So you have Lenore Walker's three-phase cycle of abuse, which is really depicting kind of a borderline man, as discussed by Amy Holthrop Monroe. And as Don Dutton pointed out, these are the kind of people that Lenore Walker was really referring to, and it's the kind of people that we've identified as fearfully attached, or Shaver and others have identified. So it seems like a lot of the research is sort of coming together, you know, these different strands are sort of coming together. And I think it's really exciting for you know, practice implications.
Yeah, I think the one thing though we have to be careful about is stereotyping the different types of attachment behaviors. So, for example, there's no evidence that shows that there are more men than women who have avoidant dismissing attachment, you know, the shutting down emotionally. And there's no evidence that shows that there's more women having anxious attachment, which is, you know, what, you know, kind of fits often the stereotype of some relationships. And so the perpetrator could be, you know, male or female, and the perpetrator or both. It could be also in a same-sex relationship with men, or same-sex relationship with women, who, by the way, have pretty high, some of the highest rates of domestic violence, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, lesbians report the highest rates of violence against them, sexual, physical, and emotional, compared to gay men or straight couples.
And right, and let's also get a. It's also important to realize what is the purpose of these, you know, maladaptive behaviors that we observe as therapists in the men and women who are anxious or avoidant. The male, you know, let's look at the anxious person. The purpose of it is not to control for the sake of controlling. It's to control for the sake of affect regulation, that when a person is feeling abandonment anxiety, they are not feeling like they're not enjoying it. It's a unpleasant state for them. And what they have learned early in their life is that if you raise the anger, or if you throw more of a fit, or if you actually try to cling on to or hold on to or not let go of a caregiver, it helps to reduce some of the anxiety. And as you mentioned, it ultimately pushes the other person away. But just, it's important for people to understand that the purpose of the behavior is to reduce the anxiety. Now,
right,
with the dismissing or the avoidant or the down-regulating type of insecure attachment, one might be tempted to think that these people are not feeling anxious. It's important to know that these people are actually feeling very anxious as the anxious people, but they have learned not to show it. In other words, they don't physically demonstrate the attachment-seeking behaviors that, for example, a secure person would, or even an anxious person would. They seem content by themselves, but in fact, they are anxious too, and they are just trying to shut down the natural instinct for seeking proximity to an attachment figure for soothing. They're just trying to shut that down as best as they can. And so that, because they don't want to be disappointed. And so I think it's important, as people think about these attachment categories, they all serve a purpose for affect regulation within the person who is demonstrating the behavior. And I think, when we look at it from that way, it's easier to feel more compassion for them. It's easier to see, wow, what they're doing has good intent, but it has such bad consequences that it only makes their situation worse.
Right. So that sort of begs the question, Daniel, that if these individuals aren't necessarily consciously thinking, you know, gee, I'm really insecure, I'm going to control my partner, they're sort of helpless and are needy of help. So, since what they're really wanting is to have their needs met, and there's nothing wrong with that, then that sort of begs the question: then how does all this information help us to develop better treatment protocols? I mean, for example, when I do my it's part of my domestic violence treatment groups. To have, as I said before, for the clients to take the experiences in close relationships questionnaire. And what I do with those findings is I just tell them, you know, we talk about it in group. I tell them, well, you scored high on anxiety over abandonment, which means that you tend to be clingy. Be on the lookout, you know, be on the lookout for when you're angry with your partner. Ask yourself, you know, why am I angry? What's going on internally with me? So that way I kind of help them get in touch with what kind of motivates them sometimes to be abusive. Tell me more about how you use attachment theory, because I know you, you know, you're working with people individually. You probably can get more in depth with your clients on their attachment issues that I can in a psychoeducational, you know, group type of setting.
Yeah, I do most of my work individually now. I stopped doing groups a number of years ago. And the way I start is exactly the way you start, which is I have them take the experiences in close relationship scale and score it. And then we talk about their attachment style and what that means. What I like about attachment theory is it's not pathologically oriented like more traditional diagnostic psychotherapy diagnostic categories.
Right. It sounds better to say to somebody you have anxiety or abandonment as opposed to you're a psychopath or you're a borderline.
Right. Or a narcissist or yeah. Whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's not as pathologizing. And we talk about, you know, not only where they are in that paradigm, attachment, but also what is going to help them, you know, if they're court mandated, they certainly have more to lose if they continue their behavior. But even if they're not court mandated, they have a lot to lose. They could lose their relationships, their marriage, their children. I mean, there's huge consequences to continuing this illegal behavior. So the focus is, you know, okay, so this is where you are. You know, you have high anxiety or you have high avoidance or you have high both. And where do we want to move? And obviously what we're trying to do with all clients who have insecure attachment, whether they have domestic violent problems or not, is to move them towards what would be considered earned security. This is a term that was developed in the attachment field for people. Remember I said that 80% of people who had insecure attachment as children are likely to have it right. as adults too. Well, you know, they discovered that about 20% of people move from an insecure attached place to a more secure place, more secure attachment style. And it's less rare. It's more rare that a person would start with secure and move to an insecure. And so they started looking at these people who went from insecure all during childhood, and then by the time they were adults were more secure. And what they found out was not surprising, that somewhere along the line there was a secure relationship that helped them grow. And that's what, again, another great quality about attachment theory is that if it's relationships that lead to insecurity, that it could then, you could also say it's relationships that are going to help a person lead to a more secure state of mind. So like I said, I start off with the experiences in close relationships, and we talk about what that means and where it's likely to come up in the context of the relationship. So for example, with an anxious person, you're going to be talking about when the partner starts demonstrating wanting to be separate in some ways, whether it's be with family, be with friends, go to work, or just want some alone time. You would want the client to become much more sensitive to the ebbs and flow of their anxiety. And that because attachment patterns are so automatic, you want them to be more conscious of the patterns of the anxiety so they can make a choice about how they're going to want to respond to that anxiety. If responding to anxiety is typically clinging, anger, demanding, controlling, those things are happening pretty automatically in those relationships, and these people don't even realize they're doing it until after the fact, perhaps.
They think it's the other person that is triggering them. And
right. Yes. Yeah. You think the other person is the cause, and therefore, if I just get the other person to stay with me, everything's going to be okay. So for an anxious person, the focus is going to be on learning to recognize what kinds of things trigger their anxiety and what are the best responses to that anxiety. I think you know, one thing that I've learned through my own experience with mindfulness meditation is that anxiety comes and goes. And a lot of times we don't have to do anything about it. We could just let it be for a while because it often dissipates on its own and we don't have to do anything. But most people think, I got to do something. I got to say something and to make it go away. And so one of the things that I teach the men and women that I work with who have a lot of anxious anxiety in their close relationships that have led to some form of abuse or not, is to teach them how to just be more observant, to be more mindful of when it gets triggered, what are the circumstances that are likely to trigger it, and just pay more attention to it. At the same time, you know, you do teach some basic affect regulation skills, deeper breathing, writing, taking a time out. You know, there's lots of other things that people can do if it's getting too intense for them and they don't feel like they're able to control their behavior. So you want them to have other kinds of strategies that they employ, because not, you know, looking at it, watching it, and waiting for it to disappear is not always going to work. So you want to give them as many strategies as possible. And it's the same thing with the dismissing. You know, when do you start shutting down? When do you find yourself starting to pull away? When do you find yourself starting to think negative thoughts about the other? All of these attachment patterns can be, you know, the person could be more mindful of them. And the more they do that, the more they, you know, they work on that, the easier it gets.
And I would add, and I know you agree with me, that in addition to helping clients with become aware of these feelings and find ways to sort of soothe themselves and regulate themselves, a lot of these individuals really need skills. Like a lot of the men I work with who are insecurely attached, you know, once I kind of point out to them that, gee, you know, you're violent because you're really insecure, it makes them feel even more insecure in some, I mean, it can, unless, yeah, of course, I teach them ways that you can legitimately feel more in control. And that is to learn assertiveness skills and learn, you know, right, communication skills. And those things are very empowering, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, because I give a lot of talks on attachment and I focus the talk on attachment, I always have to remind people that there's a lot, human behavior is very, very, very complex. And to try to reduce it to one theory, like attachment theory, is not helpful. It doesn't capture the complexity of the human mind. And so, so you're right. You can talk to them about attachment style. You can talk to them about anxiety and avoidance. But also people may need other things like just basic communication techniques. Another area that I know that you do, because we've talked about it before, which is, you know, resolving early life trauma. A lot of our clients have been abandoned, have been physically, sexually, psychologically abused. You know, that gets played out in the context of close relationships if it's not resolved and worked through. And so a good number of the men and women that I see have to address those issues as well. And then, of course, the alcohol and drugs that, you know, so there's a lot of areas that are important to touch on when you're dealing with domestic violence clients. They have multiple needs. Right. And as therapists, we have to be extremely flexible about how we address those needs.
So let me ask you just a couple more questions, Daniel, and before we regrettably end our interview, because I'm really enjoying this. But I want to ask you, in sort of the overall way that where the field is at, where do you place attachment theory in terms of sort of leading the way, I think, or showing how we can be more effective in our treatments? Because as you know, a lot of the treatment in the field doesn't work very well. Battery intervention programs have not been shown to be, at least empirically, to be shown to be as effective as we'd like them to be. So what do you think, what difference would attachment theory make in maybe making our treatments more successful?
Well, I think, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, the current state of affairs is that we have a moderate effect on behavior. But there hasn't been a lot of change in the standard protocol for the last 40 years, really, when you look at it. And that's why I think, you know, attachment theory can be helpful, using electronic, you know, software can be helpful, using electronic communications. We really need to think about ways of expanding how we address violence and aggression. And so I think attachment theory could be one of those areas, because what's good about attachment theory is, like I said, is that it's practical. It focuses on affect regulation, and we know that a lot of these men and women have problems regulating affect. So I think attachment theory could be helpful. For example, the Journey to Change, the pro-change group in Rhode Island at the University of Rhode Island, has developed a software program that they use as an adjunct to a standard domestic violence treatment. I'd like to see more use of electronic communications. Many attachment researchers are actually doing their research using texting. So, I mean, I think that there's a lot of different areas that we can start to incorporate into domestic violence work that I think will expand or improve outcomes in the long run. One of Don Dutton and I did edited a volume in the early 2000s on innovative approaches to domestic violence. And one of them was dialectic behavior therapy. There's a group up in Washington that's using that. And, you know, what's great about that is it uses, you know, CBT, but it also uses mindfulness as a huge component to it. So I'd like to see more mindfulness interventions integrated into domestic violence. So I just think that right now we want to encourage people as much as possible to try out new interventions to expand the paradigms that we've been using for the last 40 years. And one of the things I appreciate about you is that you have been using attachment theory, and I really appreciate that, because it's good to incorporate things that are not related per se to domestic violence into our domestic violence protocols. So I think
our clients, Daniel, I mean, my clients for sure, most of them don't identify, say, as batterers. Like the ones who acknowledge that they did wrong and they shouldn't have been violent, and, you know, they're not minimizing, they don't see themselves as their central identity is I'm a batterer. They see themselves as husbands or boyfriends who need to learn some skills. And so when you talk about their problems in terms of attachment, you're saying, well, you're like everyone else. We all have needs, and you're just not getting your needs met in the right way. And so it makes them feel a little bit less attacked or judged, perhaps.
Yeah, that they're trying to meet their needs in a way that ultimately doesn't get what they want, which is what they're wanting is more connection. Everybody is wanting more connection, more love, and more understanding. And the problem with insecure attachment is that these maladaptive coping mechanisms that infants learned were adaptive at the time, maybe screaming at a mother or clinging onto a mother or a father, was adaptive when they were a toddler or when they were, you know, preschool or even in school age. But as we get older, if those strategies become ingrained, then they become automatic, and we start using them in all our close relationships. And that's when once adaptive strategy becomes maladaptive. And so, yeah, it's helping them understand what's going to get them what they want. And I think, because most of the men and women that I've met who have had problems with violence, They're good people. They are just misguided in their approach to close relationships.
And that's the moment, I think, when clients seem to make that turn and become really motivated to want to change, not because they're worried about going back to jail, but they think there's something in it for them. So attachment theory also, Daniel, in my experience, helps in terms of bonding with the clients, which is very important. Clients
Yeah.
feel respected, and they feel you're connecting with them. When you frame things in terms of attachment theory, they feel like you've taken a lot of time to explore these issues and to think about them, and that you're honing in on their needs and you're trying to help them personally, which research shows is absolutely essential when you're trying to create that therapeutic bond. Daniel, I really enjoyed having you on the podcast. This is
Thank you.
podcast number two. I think we're getting started in the right way. We're going to have more podcasts, and I certainly like to invite you down the road and talk a little bit more with us if you're available.
Absolutely. And it was a pleasure talking to you too, John. And thank you for all the amazing work you've done as well.
Thank you too.
Okay.